Douglas County, and I represent the appellant Frederick Collins. This is an appeal from a plea-based conviction of first-degree sexual assault, a Class 2 felony, back in March 2013. The charges stem from sexual contact Mr. Collins alleged to have had with his stepdaughter. He was sentenced to 10 to 15 years in June 2013. At that time, Mr. Collins, or the appellant, was represented by private counsel due to a conflict with the public defender's office. After some discussions, his attorney did timely file a direct appeal, but failed to file an affidavit of poverty for the filing fee. And as a result, his first direct appeal was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. Mr. Collins filed a motion for post-conviction relief in June 2014. It contained numerous issues, including that his trial counsel was ineffective for failing to file a direct appeal. The district court granted an evidentiary hearing on the direct appeal issue and appointed counsel for that hearing, and dismissed the other issues without a hearing. The appellant did not appeal from that order. After the evidentiary hearing, the court granted appellant a new direct appeal, and that is what is before this court. The appellate issues are essentially twofold. Appellant's excessive sentence issue, which I won't address further, and then his remaining issues, which are all based on an ineffective assistance of counsel theory. All of the ineffective assistance of counsel claims were raised in one form or another in appellant's motion for post-conviction relief. The procedural issue before the court is whether this court can review those ineffective assistance claims, or whether appellate review has been waived because Mr. Collins did not appeal the order denying evidentiary hearing as to those claims.
Isn't that what our law currently is, that you've got to appeal at the time they're denied?
I think that this is a unique situation because it arises from a post-conviction motion where one of the claims is that he had no opportunity to file a direct appeal due to ineffective assistance of counsel. And then the fact that a new appeal was granted, I think, puts us in a unique procedural posture and those claims should not be waived. I think there's three reasons why I don't think those claims are waived. The first is that to say that they are waived conflates a direct appeal with an ineffective assistance, with a post-conviction motion. And they're two separate things. One's civil, one's criminal. There's procedural differences. There's standards of review that are different. But I think most importantly, the remedy is different. So when back in 2014, when the court denied his motion for post-conviction relief to all of his other claims except for his direct appeal, if he had appealed from that, his remedy would have been, okay, you get an evidentiary hearing. Whereas his remedy in this court is that the court conceivably will resolve the merits of his claims. It's not for an evidentiary hearing. So it's two separate procedures. I don't think you can conflate the two. I think more importantly, though, is you have to look at the purpose of a new appeal. So when he was granted that remedy of a new appeal, it seeks to restore the litigant in the position he would have been in had there been no ineffective assistance of counsel. So if appellant had not lost his first direct appeal due to the ineffective assistance of counsel, all of his ineffective assistance claims would have been presented first to the direct, in his direct appeal. To tell him now that you can't present those would be deprive him of the very remedy that he was granted. I think it's akin to, when a new trial is granted, the litigant gets a clean slate. You don't tell the litigant on your second trial, oh, you didn't object to that evidence on your first trial, so you can't object to it again. And I think it's the same here. A new trial gives the party a remedy of a clean slate, and a new appeal should do the same. I think that's supported by this court's jurisprudence. In State v. Mears, the court talks about restoring, in that remedy, restoring the status quo at the time of the alleged deficient performance. So the order directing that the appellant gets a new direct appeal should put him in the exact same shoes that he was in June 2013, but just in an alternate universe where trial counsel timely perfects his appeal. If that had happened, our office would have been appointed, we would have raised those ineffective assistance claims in the direct appeal, and this court would have considered them all. So I think that the remedy, in order for the remedy granted on post-conviction relief to have bite, to actually have a remedy, those claims have to come in. And then third, I think that as a matter of judicial economy, that this court should address those appeals and that, or should address those issues and not consider them waived. I think without such an order, it's going to lead to unnecessary litigation, unnecessary appeals, potentially parallel proceedings, where you get into kind of a mess of, well, should we stay this proceeding until it's done going up, to the appellate court? I think it's useful and probably legally correct to think of those remaining claims as premature. So when you, I don't think it's always the case in every post-conviction motion, because not every post-conviction motion has this direct appeal issue. But in post-conviction actions where there's a direct appeal potentially on the line, you know, granting or not granting a direct appeal does potentially render those other claims premature. And I think that that's important because, you know, prematurity is a doctrine that has an impact on how the district court should have resolved it. So here we did have a district court that ostensibly resolved, you know, somewhat the merits or maybe just the pleadings on those claims. But it's our position that this court should treat that as null and void.
So you're saying really is that there's a procedure in this type of situation where the trial court should first determine whether the defendant's entitled to a new direct appeal, and once it does that, it doesn't consider any of the other allegations raised in post-conviction because it's going to start all over
following
the direct appeal.
I do think that that is a judicious way of proceeding.
With the objective of restoring the defendant to status quo ante.
Right.
To the point in time where he or she might have had a timely appeal.
Right.
Counsel, suppose that all the facts in this case are the same except that the district court denied a new direct appeal, and we'll assume that its denial was correct. Should the waiver rule that we've followed for a number of years continue to apply in that situation?
Well, you know, so you're saying same thing happens, except instead of getting a new appeal, he denied.
Evidence at the evidentiary hearing said he never asked me, and the trial judge said credible.
I think that that's fair, and I think that this goes back to my first point, which is he would have had a right to appeal only on that direct appeal issue, but his issue wouldn't be really the merits of that. The issue would be whether or not, oh, I'm sorry, you're saying after an evidentiary hearing.
On the,
where
it's denied.
I do think that at that point, he would have gotten himself into a position where, since he didn't have the remedy ordered of the new direct appeal, where those remaining claims, he wouldn't have an avenue because he couldn't raise them in the post-conviction world, and he wouldn't have the remedy that was granted here, where he could raise them in the direct appeal world.
So you're really advocating some sort of procedure or rule only in the context where an evidentiary hearing is granted and the trial court goes on to find that a new direct appeal is justified?
I do think that's the case. I mean, I think that that's the only issue that's presented in this case. I know that the court's hearing Detterman next term, and there may be, you know, some language that needs to be addressed in there which deals with other, you know, I think that their language there was trying to apply that rule, you know, broader than just this case. But I think if you're limiting your...
Isn't your solution kind of confusing?
Well, I think that... I think it's actually less confusing because, you know, the district court only has to handle one issue, and then you don't have litigants in the limbo of, hey, do I gamble and hope that I'm going to be successful on this direct appeal, or do I put my, you know, do parallel proceedings, you know? I think that it would help to have some guidance in this area. I also think, you know, aside from the claims being premature, I do think that there's statutory language in the Post-Conviction Act that I think supports, this resolution or our position. In Section 29.3003, when it talks about a post-conviction remedy being cumulative, and it's not intended to be concurrent with any other remedy, and the last sentence of that section It says any proceeding filed under the provisions of the Post-Conviction Act, which states fact, which is... Judge, may I have a moment to...
You may.
Which, if true, would constitute grounds for relief under another remedy, shall be dismissed without prejudice. And I think that that is, aside from kind of what you can offer the, you know, in terms of, you know, supporting judicial economy and following the, you know, the principles of not adjudicating premature claims, I think you can point to that statutory directive to say, hey, you know, if there's a possibility there's going to be another remedy available to this person, you should dismiss those claims, and that dismissal should be without prejudice. I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you very much. Ms. Tangeman, good morning again.
May it please the Court, of Aaron Tangeman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. Collins was granted a new direct appeal through a post-conviction proceeding. The state filed a petition to bypass in this case to address the issue of whether claims of ineffective assistance of counsel can be addressed on the merits in a new direct appeal when those exact claims have already been raised in the post-conviction proceeding and denied by the district court. Collins raises 11 ineffective assistance of counsel claims in his brief before this court. All 11 of those claims were raised in his post-conviction motion and denied by the district court without an evidentiary hearing in a written order in 2014. That order was not appealed by Collins, and this court has held that an order denying an evidentiary hearing on a post-conviction claim is a final judgment as to that claim. Thus, the state's position is that because a final judgment was entered on those 11 claims, Collins cannot relitigate those claims a second time. I think the ultimate question before this court
is that jurisdictional, or is it a waiver of some kind?
I'm not for sure. The court in the past, in addressing those type of claims, have said jurisdiction, though it's always been on a post-conviction appeal. Here we're in a new direct appeal, but I don't think a new direct appeal is exactly the same as an original direct appeal. We're still somewhat under post-conviction proceeding. For example, the state can cross-appeal in new direct appeals. So I'm not for sure if it's properly termed as a waiver or jurisdiction, but I think the same principle applies whichever way you look at it. And I think the ultimate question that this court has to answer is, what does a new direct appeal mean? Is it a complete redo where you can raise any and all claims even if they have been litigated before? Or is it simply an opportunity to raise those claims not previously litigated? And the state's position is that a new direct appeal is not meant to give an appellant a second chance at raising claims that have been addressed by a district court.
Counsel, argues that one is civil, one is criminal, there's a different standard of review. There's different relief that can be granted. What is your comment on that?
Well, I mean, we obviously agree that all of that is correct, but I still think it comes back to the fact that the purpose of a direct appeal, the state's position, is that you get a chance to raise claims that you've never been able to raise before. And he's had the opportunity to raise those claims. And I don't know that he should be given a second chance to do that. Some of the claims that he raises on direct appeal, if this court would find they're properly before this court, are not sufficient to address on direct appeal. So then he would go back in another post-conviction motion, and you would have the district court saying, I've already addressed these, I've refuted these the first time. So I don't know that the difference in the proceedings matters, but what matters is the fact that he did have the opportunity to raise the claim, and it was looked at by a court. And he also had the ability to appeal from that order, and he chose not to do so.
But I think the import and maybe the importance of the distinction is the defendant is wandering around in this post-trial environment raising things other than the more focused procedure, which would have been a direct appeal.
Right. And the state doesn't disagree with opposing counsel's position that in the future, the proper procedure in a case like this would be for the district court to address the new direct appeal issue first. It avoids situations like this. I think it is in the interest of judicial economy And it makes sense. If he would get a new direct appeal, then raise all his ineffective claims on that direct appeal. It saves time in the district court level. It saves time on the appellate level. And we would agree with that.
So to go back to the question that I asked your opponent, if the district court facing a post-conviction motion on multiple grounds, one of which is supposed denial of direct appeal, and there are some that are clearly don't state claims, the district court disposes of those, orders an evidentiary hearing on the claim about deprivation of an appeal, and the evidence comes in where the lawyer says, he told me not to appeal.
Right.
The trial judge believes that and denies post-conviction relief on that claim. Shouldn't the denial of the other claims stand up as a waiver?
Yes, I think it should. He had the opportunity, the case law is clear in this jurisdiction, that is a final judgment as to those claims.
So are you contending that in that circumstance where it's asked for but not confessed about a new direct appeal, that the trial judge considering the post-conviction motion should somehow wait to dispose of claims that are clearly obvious without merit, or that there's no reason not to dispose of them right away? This judicial economy argument
right.
confuses me as to exactly
right.
what you're contending.
And I think it's confusing to us too. I mean, our office has had a big discussion about it, and we can see both sides of it. It doesn't make sense if there are claims that clearly have no merit or refuted or just insufficiently alleged not to dispose of them at that time. But at the same time, now I'm up here on new direct appeal, and the question is, what does a new direct appeal mean? Can you do this all again? So we see the side that if the trial court would have addressed this claim first, we wouldn't be in this situation. So I don't know that there's a perfect answer to this situation. But I think we ask guidance for this court on what the best procedure is for the district courts when this comes up in the future, because I don't know what the perfect answer is.
And you think we're more likely to know the perfect answer
yes,
than you
yes,
are?
I do.
What if someone just claims insufficient counsel because of a failure to file an appeal, and they are given a new direct appeal, and then on the new direct appeal they raise all kinds of issues that have not been raised before?
I think that's okay. I think if the new direct appeal was proper, that the purpose of that appeal is to allow them to raise any issues that they weren't allowed to raise before. And
well, the purpose of the direct appeal is to allow you to assign trial error, the error in the trial court, not necessarily ineffective assistance of counsel claims. So there weren't any claims in this case that were procedurally barred, were they, because they could have been raised on direct appeal? The court didn't make any finding about that.
There were a couple post-conviction claims where he alleged like sufficiency of the factual basis and jurisdiction. Those were dismissed in the original order. He has not relitigated those on appeal. He's not raised those on appeal and did not appeal from that order.
Those wouldn't even be ineffective. Those wouldn't be post-conviction claims, would they? Those would be claims you raise on direct appeal?
Right, and that's how the court disposed of them, said it wasn't proper for post-conviction. And then,
well, if it disposed of them that way, then they could be raised again on direct appeal.
Potentially. They weren't here.
Okay.
I will just briefly, on the merits, if this court were to find that everything starts over with a new direct appeal, I think the record is sufficient to address and refutes the majority of those claims. I think only claims the 6th, 7th, and a portion of the 10th claim, the record would not be sufficient to address on direct appeal. And I just wanted to point that out in case the court is going there and I did not set it. So unless this court has any additional questions, we would ask that you confirm this conviction.
Thank you very much.
Do we have time for rebuttal? No time for rebuttal. We will go on to In Re Estate of Lorenz. And this is a petition for further review. Mr.